Today we talk about now, how do you solve the problem of government? If you've got a free market economy or if you have a commitment to free market economics in as a nation, still, what if you have corrupt governments? And corrupt governments around the world are just at the heart of the problem of poverty. The key to that government is if its leaders will serve for the benefit of the people rather than the benefit of themselves and their friends. That's the heart of it. It really is reflected in the words of Abraham Lincoln in his Gettysburg Address, when at the end he said that government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth. What I'm saying here is the key to overcoming corruption in poor countries is if the government thinks it should serve for the benefit of the people, for the people, government for the people, for their benefit, for the good of society. You've heard Barry Esmus and me talk about the time we were with the Prime Minister of Albania. And I was able to talk with him sitting right across the table from him, and he's a Muslim. But he was willing to listen to what we were saying about the Bible's teaching on economic development. And I said, Mr. Prime Minister, could I mention to you something I think the Bible says about you? Yes. And I said, here in Romans 13:4, it says the civil government authority is God's servant for your good. And I said to him, Mr. Prime Minister, I believe that means that God has put you in leadership in Albania for the good of the nation. And that's the responsibility that you have. And he seemed to be moved and touched by that. It was very interesting. But that's what I want to get across, is that government has to serve for the good of the people, Romans 13:4. And government corruption, however, is a significant cause of poverty. Barry and I quote in this book, we quote David Moran's, actually, one of the saddest books I have ever read. Steve Ohman got me onto this book eventually, earlier, told me about it. It's called African Friends and Money Matters. And if you want to understand, Dave Neusman, you've read this book, you understand, you have some acquaintance with people in Africa or experience. He talks about 94, 92 maybe, cultural values or differences about how people view money in many sub-Saharan African countries where he's lived for about 25 years, and what he calls Westerners, that would be Americans or Europeans. And one of those is in what people think government is for. Let me read something that Moran says. In many sub-Saharan African countries, a major function of government, I'm reading from this book, but it's quoted in this book, so. A major function of government is to provide money and other resources to those members of society who are in power or have a close relationship to those in power. This unofficial role of government is widely observed in Africa. Many of the conflicts, the wars, and leaders clinging to power are direct result of the practice. The pressure is immense from above and from below on individuals in government and business to use their positions for the direct benefit of themselves and family members. Leaders in society, and then he says, religious leaders, I see some nods. Religious leaders, political leaders, and business leaders are expected to be people who distribute resources and in other ways provide for their followers when they have needs. So Moran tells a story of a church where a missionary arranged for a designated gift for something to remodel some things in the church building. And they sent it to the church, and the church entrusted it to this guy that was going to carry out the remodeling. But 6 months later, nothing had happened. Why? Well, actually, one of his relatives had a more important need, and he gave the money to them. And if the missionary objected, they said, well, you wouldn't deprive this poor man's family of their help that they needed, would you? So it's expected if you have a leadership role, you use the resources for yourself and your friends. David Landis, economic historian, probably the world's expert on economic history. In Africa, the richest people are the heads of state and their ministers. Much foreign aid, most foreign aid, question mark, ends in numbered accounts abroad. But then we say in this book, it isn't just Africa where this happens. It is a common problem throughout the history of many governments in the history of the world. In China, for centuries, the emperor ruled over all. He took whatever he wanted. In India, there were Mughal princes who were regional rulers, and they took what they wanted. The Spanish conquerors came to Central and South America and took and robbed for themselves. Feudal lords that were over these great plantations and manors in Eastern Europe, powerful kings in Britain, France, and the Holy Roman Empire similarly used their power to enrich their families for many generations. But the cultural value that says it is right for rulers to take people's money, like tax money, and use it for themselves is a violation of the Bible's view of property. As explained earlier, in earlier weeks, the Bible's teaching is that property belongs to individual people, not to the rulers. Story. King Ahab, Queen Jezebel. Ahab sees Naboth's vineyard next door to him. "I want it," he says. So he tries to buy it from Naboth. Naboth won't sell his family's vineyard. So Ahab has him killed. And of course, God brings judgment on Ahab and Jezebel. Why? Because they thought they could use government power to take for themselves rather than using the government power for the good of the people. The good example, by contrast, is Samuel, where Samuel, near the end of his reign as judge over Israel, says, "Whose ox have I taken? Whose donkey have I taken? Whom have I defrauded?" And they say, "You have not." So Samuel was not using his government office for the benefit of himself, but to serve the people. And that's the example that the Bible would hold up for leaders in poor countries who have $1 billion in their numbered bank accounts in Switzerland. That's not what God wants you to do. And you're accountable to him, and he will hold you accountable. Okay, now, point A in this outline says protection against corruption in government. This is, if you have any influence over a poor government and you are sitting at home one night with some of your friends saying, "We don't want this system to continue. Can we change it? Is there anything we can put in order to structure a government to protect against this?" So not only if you get good people in office, but even if you have some not so good people in office in 10 or 20 or 30 years, how are you going to have the system protect against that? And so now Barry and I have a number of factors here, 7 factors that will protect against corruption in government. Number one, the rule of law. All people are equally accountable to the laws, even the kings. This is the most basic guarantee that rulers use their power for the benefit of the people as a whole. And it has to include the idea that the law has moral authority so that people have a sense that they ought to obey it. The biblical example is 2 Samuel 11 to 12. That's the story of David and Bathsheba. Nathan the prophet came to David and said, "You are the man. You may be the king, you may be the most powerful man in Israel, but you, O king, are not above the law, and God holds you accountable to the law that he's given to Israel." And David repented for his great sin. Of course, God brought judgment on him and punishment. But that is the principle. Nobody's above the law. Recent examples. We have in the book President Zelaya in Honduras, in Central America, wanted to become like Hugo Chavez or Fidel Castro. He just wanted to continue in office forever as a tyrant over Honduras. But the Constitution had term limits, and his term limits were expired. Well, he decided he wanted to revise the Constitution so he could stay in office for another term and probably the rest of his life. But the Supreme Court ordered him removed from office. The military removed him from office, and he was kicked out. And that's a good example. Unfortunately, our State Department tried to support him, I think wrongfully, but that's another story. Other examples, Soviet Union, Putin and others consider themselves above the law and do what they want. Cuba, Castro and his regime. North Korea, of course, horrible example. And other examples. Now, I'm going to say what I haven't done very often here, but I am very troubled in this area. I am very troubled about the current direction of our country itself because of a pattern of government officials not being subject to the laws or not upholding the law. And most recently, we have our president saying, well, I know that the Obamacare or Affordable Care Act law says it's supposed to go into effect on such and such a day, but I'm not going to enforce that. And then there's another provision. Well, I'm not going to enforce that. The individual mandates. Well, I'm not going to enforce that. You've got to get a pass on that. So he's not upholding the law. He's just saying, well, it's not convenient, so I'm not going to enforce it. What about immigration? Some of the immigration laws, he said, well, we know the laws say this, but we're not going to enforce that because we don't like it. And what about recess appointments? Well, Congress has gone home for the weekend and they won't be back till Monday, so I'm going to make an appointment. Contrary to the rule of law, overturned by the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, it's going to the Supreme Court now. But it's just, or the IRS blatantly violating the law and investigating people who they disagree with politically. This is an erosion of the rule of law in our country. And maybe those are some indications of why that corruption perception index is not giving us perfect scores. I don't know. But you lose rule of law in a nation and it's very hard to have anything work right. Very hard for anything to work right after that. And the president's duty, the president swears an oath of office. It's very short, but it says, I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. But the Constitution of the United States says that Congress is to make the laws, and the President enforces them through the executive branch. And if he decides not to enforce them or decides to make the law himself, he's not defending the Constitution. So that's an aside. You may disagree with me or you may say, hey, wait a minute, there's some other people who have been done wrong on that too. That's fine if you want to do that. But I'm just saying, as I was going through the notes last night, it did trouble me that the erosion of rule of law is an erosion of at the very foundation of society. Number two, related to this, a fair court system. Courts show no favoritism or bias, but enforce justice impartially because the courts are the primary means of guaranteeing that everybody in a nation is subject to the rule of law. And the Bible strongly emphasizes that judges must be fair and not pervert justice. So Margaret and I have a friend in another state who owned a manufacturing plant in China. And the business partner that they had an agreement with left, and his brother came in and took over the plant and just put a padlock on the door, and all of a sudden they have some millions of dollars worth of inventory. They can't get it out. And they go to court, and the court won't do anything because the guy's in cahoots with the courts. So this company lost in the millions of dollars because they wouldn't pay an extortion fee to the guy who put a padlock on the door, and they couldn't get the courts to do anything because the court was corrupt. Now, once that happens, would you like to do business in that state or that city or that province anymore? No, the risk is way too high. But what does the Bible say about that? It gives a counter example to that. It says, you shall appoint judges and officers in all your towns. They shall judge the people with righteous judgment. You shall not pervert justice, you shall not show partiality, and you shall not accept a bribe. For a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and subverts the cause of the righteous. Justice, and only justice, shall you follow, that you may live and inherit the land that the Lord your God is giving you. Number three, related to that, although we made it explicit here, absence of bribery and corruption in government offices. Again and again in the Bible, officials are warned against taking bribes. I just read that passage from Deuteronomy. Again, Exodus 23:3, nor shall you be partial to a poor man in his lawsuit, but you shall not pervert the justice due to the poor man in his lawsuit. Exodus 23:3 and 23:6, you don't favor the poor man because he's poor, and you don't oppose the poor man because he's poor. You just do justice. People are warned against taking bribes. Now, we had another example that we came across in one of the countries that Barry and I visited where we were meeting with a Christian who was our host in this country. He was a top-ranking lawyer in the country and had a high position in the government. He had bought land outside the capital city. He had it for a year, and he couldn't get a permit to build a house on that land that he bought to build a house on because he wasn't going to pay a bribe. But then he couldn't get the permit, and he's one of the highest-ranking lawyers in the country. And even he couldn't get it because the bribery system was so endemic in that nation. Well, so now, what does that do to business? It just bleeds away your ability to be productive. It just hinders the economic productivity of a country. And it means people don't want to invest in that country because their investments are at risk, because they don't know when the bribes are going to become demanded that they prevent the business from taking the actions that they want and need to take. So point B, the solution. Government officials should be reasonably compensated for their service. Yes, we don't want people to say, well, for what they pay me as a policeman, I can't support my family. Well, there's something going on wrong there. They should be reasonably compensated. But laws should prevent them from becoming wealthy through, quote, gifts or promises received while they are in office. Bribery and corruption have enormously hindered economic development in Eastern Europe, pre-British India, and many African societies. And similar corruption is common in communist countries and many Islamic countries. So I'm not going to go into details on that. The Old Testament warned against a powerful official such as a king becoming wealthy while in office. He shall not accumulate for himself, Deuteronomy 17:17, he shall not acquire for himself excessive silver and gold. And I didn't realize this for many years, but the story of Solomon, I thought, oh, isn't this amazing? Solomon's getting all this gold, and he's growing the kingdom, he's advancing the kingdom. But it wasn't until somebody pointed out to me, Solomon is beginning to disobey the command in Deuteronomy 17:17. He shall not acquire for himself excessive silver and gold. And his heart got carried away for that, and even though he was warned against it. But the positive examples are Samuel, for instance, who didn't defraud people and take bribes, Paul telling Timothy to carry out his rules without favoritism. Why does corruption persist in poor countries? So now Paul Collier, who's an Oxford professor but was overseeing the either the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund, I've forgotten, overseeing foreign development in these funds for many years, very, very recognized world expert on economic development, Paul Collier, he says, why is bad government so persistent in some environments? One evident reason is that not everyone loses from it, from bad government. The leaders of the poorest countries in the world are themselves among the global super rich. They like things the way they are. Somebody just said yes over here. Sobering, but tragic. Now, what we say in this book is, change in poor countries can only come about by heroic leaders in the countries themselves making these changes. And there are examples of that. Why is Botswana right here? Why is Botswana becoming the success story in sub-Saharan Africa? It's the first country north of South Africa. Well, they have an example of a king who was a Christian, Seretse Khama, when vast diamond wealth and other mineral wealth was developed, and he put in place policies so that the individual tribe wouldn't benefit from it, but it would be used wisely for the benefit of the nation as a whole. And there are many other reforms and laws that have been coming about. Botswana, I wouldn't be surprised to change color to blue one of these years, to green, from blue to green, because there are examples of people not using government power for their own benefit. And, of course, just in our recent memory now, Nelson Mandela passed away. And what I was reading about him is he was so popular, he could have been king for life in South Africa. But he stepped aside and wanted to set an example of peaceful transition of government and not enriching himself or perpetuating his own power. So there are some good examples as well of absence of bribery and corruption. Number four, adequate power of government. Governments have to have enough power to maintain their own stability. Italy, Spain, Portugal, and Latin America in the 19th century experienced problems of instability and that hindered their economic growth. And Acemoglu and Robinson, two economic historians, a book that's called this recently published book called Why Nations Fail, talk about a lack of centralization in government that leads to disorder and poverty. And they say, Afghanistan, big problem, no effective central government. Haiti, no crime is wild, runs rampant, and no effective central government. Nepal, sadly. Somalia, for sure. And Iraq under Saddam Hussein was tyrannical, but now I'm afraid Iraq is degenerating into anarchy as the American military has pulled out. Well, Somalia is off the west coast of Africa, and that's where all that piracy is occurring. You want to take a pleasure cruise past Somalia? Well, now maybe the enforcement against piracy is a little more effective. But no, you don't want to go there. You don't want to do business there because piracy and crime. So if you don't have adequate power of government, there's anarchy, and it's dangerous, and it'll hinder the economy. Judges 17 to 21 shows what happens when there's no government at all. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes, and there's horrible crime and corruption in the end of Judges as a result. So you have to have a strong enough government. But then on the other hand, you can't have a too strong government. Number five, you have to have a limited power for the government. The power of a government must be limited enough so it doesn't take too much freedom from the people. There's a trade-off between government power and individual freedom, because when there's greater power in government, there's greater potential of corruption. So there are tyrannical governments historically that have prevented a society from increasing its prosperity. China, many early inventions, but remained in abject poverty because the Chinese state was always interfering with private enterprise, says David Landis, taking over lucrative activities, prohibiting others, manipulating prices, exacting bribes, curtailing private enrichment. Russia, the all-powerful czars, for decades, for centuries, controlled all of life. Many African nations, tribal chiefs exercised nearly unlimited rule, excessive power. In Africa, the legacy was rule by a strong man, says Landis, autocratic embodiment of the popular will, hence slayer of democracy. How can government power be limited then? How can government power be limited? Government must effectively be accountable to the will of the people. And now, there are a number of countries that have effectively limited government power, and the government is accountable to the people. The United Kingdom is one. Scandinavian countries are another. Other European countries. But the example that Barry and I know best is the United States. And the Constitution of the United States was set up in a remarkable way to protect people from government. It was first set up a strong enough government. It was stronger than the Confederated States before the Constitution, so that it could function effectively. But then there are many provisions in the U.S. Constitution that keep the central government of the United States from becoming too strong, basically to protect people from the government. And so here are some examples. There's a three-way separation of powers at the national level between the executive branch, the judicial branch, and the legislative branch. And then there's a separation of powers between national governments and state and local governments. So what is happening, here's an example. Kathy Herod just mentioned this law in Arizona. Arizona passed a law prohibiting abortions after 20 weeks. That wasn't a U.S. law, federal law, but it's Arizona passing a law on its own because there's independence to a certain degree for the states. Now this law is being tested at the national level, but if it's upheld by the Supreme Court, then it becomes an example for other states that they can enact such a law as well. And in that way, the states have some restraining power on the federal government. And we're seeing that back and forth with the medical insurance dispute as well, with different states filing lawsuits against it, things like that. So a separation of powers between national governments and state and local governments. There are some countries in Latin America, there are some countries in Africa, where if you want to take over the country, you just have to take over the army. Why does that help you take over the country? Because the army runs all the local police as well. And so you've, all of a sudden you're controlling all the villages and all the townships and all the counties and all the provinces. You're controlling the whole thing because the army runs the whole thing. The United States was set up so that doesn't happen. Does the United States control local police forces? No. Doesn't control the Scottsdale Police Department. It does not control Joe Arpaio and Maricopa County Sheriff's Office. Joe Arpaio doesn't, the Maricopa County Sheriff, doesn't control the city government police departments or the other various cities. And Santa Fe or Albuquerque police departments are not accountable to anybody in Arizona. So there's separation. It's a protection against anybody getting too much power and taking over the country by taking over the army. So there's separation of powers. And then freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of religion, and freedom of assembly. So freedom of speech means you can't be arrested for criticizing the government. You might have your income tax return audited, I guess. I don't know. But see, what's happening is people are rebelling against that abuse by the IRS because they want to protect freedom of speech. And if you have freedom of speech to criticize the government, that holds government accountable. Freedom of the press, so that you can have, and you have had throughout the history of the United States, various newspapers and now radio and TV, some support the government, some oppose it, but there's freedom to do that. Freedom of religion, because I can stand here and teach and say, you know, I disagree with something that's being done by the IRS right now. And you have freedom to go to, maybe in the question and answer time, to say you disagree, but there's freedom to do that. Why is China afraid of freedom of religion? Because they're afraid it will threaten the government's exclusive hold on power. And freedom of assembly, so you can't be arrested for getting together to form a political party to oppose the government. And then freedom to petition the government for redress of grievances without being put in jail. And then the right to bear arms is a way of saying we're not going to let any national government or tyrant take over the country because citizens have a right to defend themselves even against a tyrant. Term limits for the office of president, again, is a way of prohibiting anybody from becoming too powerful, like Chavez in Venezuela or Castro in Cuba and his regime. And then, number five, the regular election of members of Congress. I think this is one of the greatest protections against government becoming too powerful and corrupt in the United States, because every 2 years, members of Congress have to be elected, representatives, and then every 6 years, the senators. And all of a sudden, there was an election in 2012 that brought some corrective into what the people of the United States said is happening in the government. We're going to elect the other party to have more congressmen this time. And then that is functioning right now, because the 2014 election is coming up and the members of Congress are worried about whether they're going to be reelected or not. That means they're accountable to the people. I don't know if you've done this. You go to a town hall meeting where some of your senator or your congressman is there and they answer questions. They know they're accountable to people. They listen because they have to be regularly reelected. So those are a lot of provisions to protect against excessive government power. I have here in the outline point C, several passages in the Bible support the idea of limited government power and separation of powers. Kings who had unchecked power and abused it were King Saul or David with Bathsheba and then Solomon later in his life and then Rehoboam, certainly, in the divided monarchy. But the Bible contains examples of divided power where the tribes, clans, and families separated power in the Old Testament. And the nation of Israel, 12 apostles, not just one, to rule over the church after Jesus left. James and Peter were both spokesmen for the apostles in the Jerusalem church and the Jerusalem council. And then there were government by plural elders in local churches. Okay, so that is a protection against corruption. If powers are separated, the next page, government accountability to the people as well. Regular elections and there's something else built into our foundational government, part of our government. In the Declaration of Independence, it says, which really brought the United States into being, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, among these, and that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. Then here's the key phrase, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. So it was saying, God gave you these rights, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, and other rights. Government is supposed to protect those from you. And so in order for government to protect those rights for you, not from you, protect those rights, you have to give it that power. You have to agree that the government is going to protect that power. Government doesn't in itself have right apart from the consent of the governed. I think that was an amazingly shrewd insight. It stemmed back to the Mayflower Compact in 1620, where the people of the early colony there in Massachusetts, where the people in the Mayflower Compact mandated a government by consent of the governed, and that found fuller expression in the Declaration of Independence. So I think that much of the prosperity for our history since the United States was founded was this accountability of government to the people. Okay, that's protections of government, protections against corrupt government. Now I'm watching the clock. I've got a problem. Let me try this. I'll try five more minutes, and then we're going to interact no matter where I am, and then I'm not sure what we'll do. But let's protection against crime, because if you have a high crime area, you don't want to start a business there. Government should do that. Number nine, protection against disease. Why don't we have malaria and cholera and typhoid fever in the United States? Because the government has sanitation that protects us against that, and it kills the mosquitoes that spread malaria, mostly. Protection against violation of contracts, very important because you have to be able to count on people fulfilling what they agree to do. And as Fred Beasley said, and David Morantz say, that's really uncommon in Africa. People who agree to do something then won't finish the job, then demand more money. They violate contracts. Government can protect that. Protection against foreign invasion. When Hitler invaded much of Europe, it was destructive. And then the Soviet Union took over much of Eastern Europe and really kept those nations in poverty for many years. And it's like the Philistines ruling over Israel and or the Moabites and destroying all their crops. A government has to be strong enough to protect against that. And then avoidance of wars, of conquest and civil wars. A very, very destructive factor in many poor countries is launching wars of conquest against another country. And we list in our book here Acemoglu and Robinson, MIT and Harvard professors, say that here are examples of bloody civil wars that have happened in Africa. Angola, Burundi, Chad, Cote d'Ivoire, or Ivory Coast, Democratic Republic of the Congo, Ethiopia, Liberia, Mozambique, Nigeria, Republic of the Congo, Brazzaville, Rwanda, Somalia, Sudan, Uganda, Sierra Leone. These are bloody civil, these conflicts turned into bloody civil wars, creating economic ruin and unparalleled human suffering, as well as caused state failure. What's happening right now, within the last week? South Sudan, the new country that was established out of Sudan and has a lot of the oil wealth, two different tribes battling over the control of the oil resources because of this idea that government can take the resources for itself. So there has to be protection, avoidance of wars somehow, by the government having measures to protect itself against that. Protection against destruction of the environment. Those are seven factors that the government should protect, and then things government should promote. If it wants to do good for the nation, Romans 13:4, there are things it should promote. Compulsory universal education, for instance. I think it's a good thing that people have to go to school, high school in the United States up to a certain level until they attain minimal competency to earn a living. I don't know that it's actually effective as it's supposed to be in all cases, but I think it's a wise thing. It's healthy for society. And in Protestant Northern Europe, everybody was taught to read. There are high levels of literacy, and Northern Europe became wealthy far ahead of Southern Europe, where Roman Catholics were discouraged from reading the Bible, and there were many people that didn't know how to read, even in the early 1900s. Now, the Roman Catholic Church today does encourage literacy, but it didn't in previous centuries. And we say in this outline on the top of the next page, Muslim nations in the Middle East, illiteracy rates are high, much higher for women than men. And we quote some statistics where in some Muslim nations in North Africa, illiteracy among women is over 50%. Tragic. If you can't read, how can you earn a living? It's amazing. It's tragic. And in Hindu culture, we quote this book by Daryl Miller saying, encouraging the poor to learn in some parts of Hindu culture is thought to be sinning. It's morally wrong to encourage poor people to learn. They deserve not to learn. That's tragic. Here's something else. Point H, foreign language is important as those who cannot speak multiple languages are limited in economic opportunities. And there's one language that lets you go throughout the world and conduct business and have a successful business. And that language is the one you all speak. It's English. So Barry Asmus and I go to Albania. Three-fourths of the people in our audience speak English. We go to China. All the little kids want to speak English. They want to practice English with us. We're in Hungary. We're in Poland. People are eager to practice English, and children are learning English. We go to Germany. People are fluent in English. Go to Scandinavia. People learn English. Tragic exception, South America. Why? Why is South America not requiring English in many countries, not requiring English in elementary schools? I think it's a misguided sense we don't want to be too much like the United States. I don't know if that's the reason, but it's a tragic thing because it limits the opportunities for economic development and interaction with other countries in economic basis in the future. Number 16, laws that give protection and positive economic incentives to stable family cultures. A child growing up in a family with both the father and mother present is far less likely to end up in poverty. In 2009, the poverty rate for single parents with children was 37%, over one in three single parents poor. But married family with children, poverty rate only 6.8%. It was five times greater if there's only a single parent. And so when government can protect can preserve marriage and protect marriage and honor marriage, it is a great incentive that helps economic stability. And so point C, government should adopt laws that provide incentives to getting and staying married and for raising children, not promoting same-sex relationships as a type of marriage because they do not bring the same benefits to society. There are many other reasons for this position that I've talked about, but economically, I think long run it's harmful. And I skipped B, subsection 1. In poor countries, the cause of single parenthood or orphans is generally disease or war, but there are negative consequences in terms of economic development from that, and that's a tragedy that needs to be addressed. And then number 17, laws that protect freedom of religion for all religious groups. Japan in 1612 banned all Christians and trapped itself in poverty because of lack of international trade for over 100 years, and many Muslim nations today prohibiting non-Muslims from being active and participating in the society. So I did get through the outline. what's the big picture? There's a lot that government can do. The government can protect against corruption. government can protect against certain harms, crimes, and disease and war that will harm the economy, and government can encourage things like education and freedom of religion that will help a country grow economically. So that's a lot of points. I think there were 17 points that governments could consider if they can improve in any of these areas. Any one that they improve in is going to help their country to some degree. And the more they can improve in, the better it is. Okay, we have a few minutes, 6 or 7 minutes maybe, for your comments or questions or interaction. So, and Rick, okay, Winston, or Wilson. There's a microphone coming, just a second. Thank you.
I thought it was very interesting you brought up the fact of people in our government not supporting what the Constitution says.
Yeah.
I think it would be also interesting for us to relate how many people here feel that this is true, that the government is not supporting what the Constitution says.
Yeah.
Would you stand up?
I'm not going to do that because I don't want to put people on the spot. But you got nods of appreciation, and you got this kind of action going throughout the class. So thanks, Wilson. And you've been in a lot of countries as on mission work, too. I know you have on dental work. Okay. Gene, oh, Rick?
We were on a medical mission trip with Wilson in Mexico.
Yes.
And we had boxes of meds, and we had a letter from the governor saying we could bring them in. And
right.
Whatever. Well, the officials at the airport said we need to pay a bribe.
Yep.
Wilson wouldn't do it.
Yep.
He sent the meds back. We bought meds and contributed meds.
Okay. Good. Gene.
You had said earlier that the government leaders have the most influence, but I think elsewhere in your book you talk about pastors
yep.
being able to. With the leadership forum coming up this spring, will these books be provided to those pastors?
I'm going to make a presentation on the book at two different sessions for the European Leadership Forum in Wisla, Poland in late May. So to some extent it'll be available. I don't know how many copies of the book they'll be available for. But Gene, I think what you say is important. People can sit in a poor country and say, oh, these rulers are so corrupt, they're taking all the money for themselves, they'll never change. Well, are you a pastor? Yes. Well, how about preaching on this? See, and if 100 or 1,000 pastors start teaching these things in their churches, then all of a sudden the next generation of leaders anyway will have the right ideas.
I think there would be a lot of support for funding those books so that every pastor has one, as you we did with the study Bible.
Interesting. Let me think about that. Give me comments if you agree with Gene later after class. Okay, we did about 3 or 4 years ago send 625 or more copies of the ESV Study Bible to the European Leadership Forum. Every person who registered got one, and they were wonderfully appreciated. So, I don't know. Possibly. They're a lot cheaper. What else? More comments? Dave Nussman here.
You mentioned South Sudan, and we have a dear friend in South Sudan who is a pastor.
Where is that, Dave? Is that? Am I in the right area?
A little more, yeah, about a little south, I think, yeah.
In here? It's maybe in here someplace.
And, well, and since Uganda, South Sudan came into being about 2 years ago now, he was here, and we asked him why he wouldn't get involved in government because yeah. he's a very bright guy. And he said many pastors have gotten involved in government, and in the process of they have become corrupted.
Oh, wow.
And now he was kidnapped by the local government
wow.
on May 19th, and he wasn't released until well into November.
Whoa.
Came out terrible condition, now has malaria.
Oh, no.
It's a very, very tough thing.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And the comment on the corruption in Kenya. We were there 8 years ago,
yeah.
and a dear friend of ours, a native Kenyan, was trying to get a permit for their education program in Nairobi, and they kept sending the application down, totally completed, got turned back every time.
Yeah.
He then went down personally and presented the permit request. noticed the young man's name and who was taking it. He said, "Oh, that's a very fine Christian name. I'm glad to see that, because a Christian would never accept a bribe." And he got his permit.
Oh, wow. Okay. So little by little, change can happen.
And he has written a book, When Leadership Becomes Corrupt? When the Best Are Corrupt.
Yeah. Okay. Wow.
It's an amazing experience.
Yeah, we've run into this too. And I come back to what we say. Only heroic leaders in poor countries can change the situation. That's the only solution I know. But if they know how, if they know what the goal is, maybe there's more hope. So, okay, Lisa. No, is it Lisa? Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
So many would say that President Obama has abused his power by failing to enforce his own law, Obamacare, or changing it at will, or giving exceptions, etc. So I'm just curious, which branch of government is supposed to hold him in check, and
courts.
Why isn't that happening?
The courts are supposed to hold him in check, but the process takes so long to work through the federal trial court level, and the trial takes a long time, and then the appeals court level, and then Supreme Court only accepts, I don't know, they get 8,000 cases a year sent to them, and they accept 80, or something like that. It's in those general proportions. So, and then he does it again in some other area, and then you take another case. Now, some of those cases are working their way through the courts, but they take forever. So, but there is another means of accountability, and that is the ballot box. So the question is whether the United States people as a whole are saying, whether it's a Democrat or Republican, this disobedience to the rule of law is so serious a problem in our country that we cannot tolerate it. So, if in the next 10 months there are town halls where people running for Congress are campaigning in your district, you can show up and ask about this or voice it. I mean, so there is the opportunity to give some measure of accountability in saying, are you going to support this or are you going to oppose this if you get elected? So, anyway. Senate and House committees can call hearings and things too, so there's some measure of accountability that way. But it's a hard question. One more. Anybody else? Okay. You are going to love next week because it's about freedom. It's about freedoms that a government is supposed to protect. And so, that's what? Oh, no. Next week is Peter and Dirk. So then the week after that is the freedoms the government is supposed to protect in a country and why those are very important. Lord, we recognize these things. I just sense and hear and see kind of general consent that these issues are important in our country, yes, but oh, so much more blatantly disobeyed in poor countries, many poor countries. And Lord, we do ask, as Dave Nussman has mentioned, that there would be heroic leaders in poor countries who would rise up and begin to bring changes in these areas, and that you would protect them and give blessing to their effort. And help us as we have opportunity to influence those who have influence in poor countries as well. And we ask for our nation that you would make us wise in how we speak and interact with people and give mercy to our nation and understanding of the direction that the nation is taking and needs to take. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.